The Greek word apokalypsis, from which we get the English word apocalypse, literally means to reveal, to disclose, to uncover, to lift the veil. Prophecy in ancient Israel, even down to the period of the Babylonian exile, had little to do with predicting the future or forecasting historical events. The great prophets of Israel, such as Isaiah or Jeremiah, were primarily concerned with delivering the word of the Lord, meaning oracles calling on the people to respond to divine direction. In other words, apocalyptic literature discloses what we might call a transcendent reality. It is meant to influence both the behavior and understanding of the reader by means of divine authority. In chapter 1, verse 10 of the Revelation, the disciple John tells us that he was in the Spirit on the Lord's day. In this deep state, he was caught up in the Spirit of God and turned, according to Revelation 1:12, away from the outer world. He began viewing the inner heavenly world and was told to write what he saw and heard. So what John perceived was for his own personal spiritual development, as well as for other souls who by their own development could sense the true meaning of this story and its strange imagery and use it to benefit their own journey. The process John went through to have this revelatory experience combined with the content of the experience reveals a spiritual, mystical approach to life. The mystical approach is founded upon a belief that each of us can have an immediate intuitive perception of spiritual truths. A transcend ordinary intellectual understanding by a direct, intimate union of our soul with God. A way is now open to experience the Spirit of God and truth directly, not for one or two selected people, but any and all who seek. As Revelation 1:5-6 states, Jesus Christ is the faithful witness, the firstborn of the dead and the ruler of the kings of the earth. In Jewish tradition, the high priest entered the Holy of Holies and experienced direct contact with God. Now, anyone who asks will receive, who seeks will find, who knocks it will be opened to them. In order to understand this mysterious multi-layered text, we must remember that ancient Hebrew, like Greek and other languages, did not have a separate set of characters to indicate numbers, but simply used the letters of its alphabet to represent numbers. This fact provides the basis of an ancient practice of gematria, in which numerical equivalents of words and names are calculated. Gematria is based on the idea that one may discover hidden meaning in the biblical text from a study of the numerical equivalents of the Hebrew letters. The first letter of Hebrew alphabet, Aleph, represents one, Beth, the second letter represents two, and so on. To understand properly the number systems of the biblical world, we must look to the neighbors of Israel. The Egyptians were already using relatively advanced mathematics by 3000 BC. The construction of such structures as the pyramids required an understanding of complex mathematics. The Sumerians, by the same time, had developed their own number system. We still make use of remnants of the Sumerian system today in our understanding of time. 12 hours for day, 12 hours for night, 60 minutes, 60 seconds as divisions of time. In addition to their uses to signify, to designate specific numbers or quantities, many numbers in the Bible carry a symbolic meaning. For instance, 7 came to symbolize completeness and perfection. God's work of creation was both complete and perfect, and it was completed in 7 days to make that symbolic statement. Israelites were to remember the land and to give it a Sabbath, permitting it to lie fallow in the seventh year. Major festivals such as Passover, Tabernacle, lasted 7 days, as did wedding festivals. In Pharaoh's dream, the 7 good years are followed by 7 years of famine, representing a complete cycle of plenty and famine. Multiples of 7 had symbolic meaning. The year of Jubilee came after the completion of every 49 years. In the year of Jubilee, all Jewish bond slaves were released, and land which had been sold reverted to its former owners. Another multiple of 7 used in the Bible is 70. 70 elders are mentioned in Exodus. Jesus sent out the 70. 70 years is specified as the length of the exile. The Messianic kingdom was to be inaugurated after a period of 70 weeks of years had passed. Jesus taught that forgiveness is not to be limited even to a full number or complete number of instances. We are to forgive not merely 7 times, already a gracious number of forgivenesses, but 70 times 7, limitless forgiveness beyond keeping count. The menorah had 7 candlesticks named peace, benevolence, harmony, light, truth, brotherly love, and justice. The 7 churches symbolized by their number all the churches. These represent the 7 spiritual centers within the body. In classical Hinduism and Buddhism, these centers are called chakras, which means wheels, spinning wheels of energy located in specific areas of the human body. These centers have been correlated to the endocrine glands, which secrete the powerful hormone messages directly into the bloodstream, affecting all parts of the body. Each of these churches represents a specific spiritual center. The virtue and the fault of each church symbolizes the virtue and fault of that spiritual center within us. These powerful centers affect the soul and mind inhabiting the body. Therefore, the Spirit moves through each church, calling on it to overcome its weaknesses and to do what it knows to do, so that the final glory may be achieved, helping us to prepare for the spiritualization of the mind and heart described in subsequent chapters of the Revelation. The 7 lamps of fire represent the helpful influences that destroy obstacles to spiritual awakening. These represent the helpful influences that destroy hindrances to that process. They are inner messengers, aides who stand between the forces of good and evil and become as powers within the nature of human beings to overcome. This idea may be an extension of the teaching that angels watch over us. An example of this can be found in Psalm 91, "For he will give his angels charge over you to keep you in all your ways." So the number 7 represents perfection, the divine number. After 7, the most significant number for the Bible is 12. The Sumerians used 12 as one base for their number system. Both the calendar and the signs of the zodiac reflect this 12-base number system. The tribes of Israel and Jesus' disciples numbered 12. The importance of the number 12 was evident in the effort to maintain that number. When Levi ceased to be counted among the tribes, the Joseph tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh, were counted separately to keep the number 12 intact. In the New Testament, when Judas Iscariot committed suicide, the 11 moved quickly to add another to keep their number at 12. 12 seems to have been especially significant in the book of Revelation. The New Jerusalem had 12 gates. Its walls had 12 foundations. The Tree of Life yielded 12 kinds of fruit. Multiples of 12 are also important. There were the 24 divisions of priests and 24 elders around the heavenly throne. The Parkfold tradition holds that 72 Jewish scholars, six from each of the 12 tribes, translated the Old Testament into Greek to give us the version we call the Septuagint. Three is also a symbolic number, often indicating completeness. Prayer was to be lifted up three times daily. Psalm 55, but I call upon God and the Lord will save me evening and morning at noon. I utter my complaint and moan and he will hear my voice. In Daniel 6, we read, although Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he continued to go to his house, which had windows in its upper room open towards Jerusalem, and to get down on his knees three times a day to pray to his God and praise him. The sanctuary had three main parts, vestibule, nave, inner sanctuary. Three-year-old animals were mature and were therefore prized for special sacrifices. Jesus is said to have been in the grave for 3 days and three nights, the same amount of time Jonah was in the great fish. Four was also used as a sacred number. Significant biblical references to four include the four corners of the earth, the four winds, the four rivers which flowed out of Eden to water the world, and the four living creatures surrounding God. God sent forth the four horsemen of the apocalypse to bring devastation to the earth. Among the ancients, four was considered representative of the world of humanity. For example, there were the four elements, fire, air, earth, water, four seasons, spring, summer, fall, winter, four eras of human growth, infancy, youth, maturity, old age, and four eras of historical growth, gold, silver, bronze, iron. In the book of Revelation, we find the four beasts. These can be understood as the four fundamental desires of human beings which must be overcome. Revelation's description of each adds to our understanding of these forces and how we may subdue their negative qualities. The most important multiple of four is 40, which often represents a large number or long period of time. Rain flooded the earth for 40 days. For 40 days, Jesus withstood Satan's temptations. 40 years represented approximately a generation. Thus, all the adults who had rebelled against God at Sinai during the 40 years of the wilderness wandering period. By age 40, a person had reached maturity. Ordinary letters were used both as letters and as numbers. The result was that some numbers would spell significant words, and some words had significant numerical value. Gematria was used in the Greek, in the Hebrew, and in Arabic languages. Consider this famous passage from Revelation. This calls for wisdom. Let anyone with understanding calculate the number of the beast. For it is the number of a person, its number is 666. The number 6 is a symbol for imperfection. So it is the number representing humanity. The number 666 in Revelation is often taken as a reverse gematria for the Emperor Nero. The name Nero Caesar, put in Hebrew characters, add up to a total of 666. Since 6 represents lack or incompleteness, in contrast to the number 7 representing completion, the triple 666 represents evil. We can then understand that a term like the mark of the beast is a symbol for the unevolved animalistic force within humans. If the meaning of 666 is in the number itself, then the point is clear. The beast is nothing more than human beings under demonic control. In that sense, the beast has always been with us, and he can be seen at work throughout the ages. The beast is like our ego and egocentric interests. It represents the work of self alone without God's influence. The mark is erased when the work of our hands and thoughts of our minds are cooperating with God rather than simply being self-driven. The beast is our lower nature at our most selfish, self-centered, self-gratifying, self-glorifying point of existence. The beast rising out of the sea is the selfish, animalistic desires that arise which are capable of ruling humanity. In the symbolism of the apocalypse, such terms as death and life usually refer to spiritual death, such as leave the dead, bury the dead. Death means to be devoid of spiritual awareness, to be without belief in God. Sleep means the slumber of heedlessness, to be temporarily devoid of spiritual awareness. Life means to have entered the paradise of the love of God. So the famous reference to Armageddon can be understood to mean the spiritual conflict within human beings. Let's now take a look at some of the other symbolism in Revelation, specifically embedded in verses. Revelation 1:7. Loki is coming with the clouds. Every eye will see him, even those who pierced him. And on his account all the tribes of the earth will wail. So it is to be. Amen. The word spiritual should be associated with the word eyes. This is a reference to the eyes of the mind and heart. To see is to understand. In his right hand he held seven stars. From his mouth came a sharp two-edged sword, and his face was like the sun, shining with full force. When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead. But he placed his right hand on me, saying, "Do not be afraid. I am the first and the last and the living one. I was dead, and see, I am alive forever and ever. I have the keys of death and of Hades." The right hand is the hand of power and might. As the spirit of truth, he speaks with the sword of truth, double-edged, because it separates the true from the false, and the good from the wicked. The sun symbolizes divinity, the manifestations of God. "But I have a few things against you," Revelation 2. "You have some there who hold the teaching to the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the people of Israel so that they would eat food sacrificed to idols." Idol worship is equivalent to the modern day doctrine of materialism. To eat things sacrificed to idols means to believe in, to swallow idolatrous teachings, just as the consuming of the bread and wine of the Eucharist symbolizes the acceptance of Christ's teachings and of his sacrifice. "Yet you have still a few people in Sardis who have not soiled their clothes. They will walk with me dressed in white, for they are worthy. If you conquer, you will be clothed like them in white robes, and I will not blot out your name from the book of life. I will confess your name before my Father and before his angels. Let anyone who has an ear listen to what the Spirit is saying to the churches." Revelation 3. Raiment, garment, clothing mean the character or attributes of the soul. What a person dresses in refers not to literal clothing of the body, but to the clothing of the mind, to mental beliefs and attitudes. All of us are dressed up psychologically in opinions which form mental garments. Revelation 12, the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. The great red dragon symbolizes that powerful urge within ourselves that originally so separated us from the source of life, that we fight with those very influences that would bring spiritual awakening. The great red dragon is the serpent from the garden in Genesis who first aided in our soul's separation from God's presence. Revelation 14, then another angel, a second, followed, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her evil ways." Babylon represents the human desire for earthly riches and success in the gratification of the flesh. Revelations 2:13. "I know where you are living, where Satan's throne is, yet you are holding fast to my name, and you did not deny your faith in me, even in the days of Antipas, my witness, my faithful one who was killed among you, where Satan lives." We can understand the reference to the idea of Satan as the force of self-centeredness, self-gratification, self-indulgence, self-importance, self-righteousness, self-glorification, self-delusion, self-condemnation, ego, the false god, the beast. "And I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000, sealed out of every tribe of the people of Israel, from the tribe of Judah, 12,000 sealed, from the tribe of Reuben, from the tribe of Gad, from the tribe of Asher, from the tribe of Benjamin, 12,000 sealed." 144,000 is the first group to be sealed and protected from what is coming. Revelation 14 describes them as those who were redeemed from the earth. John says that they have not defiled themselves. The 144,000 follow the Lamb wherever he goes, and no lie was found in their mouths. The context suggests that the 144,000 symbolize those who are true to God and God's ways. This group is composed of the spiritually purified, who do not follow false religious and philosophical teachings. They have not refused to repent of ungodly behavior. They are true to God's perfect way. Those whom God has sealed will survive the outpouring of God's wrath. They may suffer trials, persecution, even martyrdom, but they are saved for eternal life. The sealing of God's servant has much in common with the vision of the prophet Ezekiel, which he experienced when he saw figures in Jerusalem, which is a symbol of the righteous remnant among the tribes of Israel, disturbed over the sins being committed in the city. They also received a mark on the forehead as a sign of their faithfulness to God's ways. Ezekiel 9. "The Lord called to the man clothed in linen, who had the writing case at his side, and said to him, 'Go through the city, through Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of those who sigh and groan over all the abominations that are committed in it.'" To be sealed is a symbolic way of saying that the 144,000 are identified as belonging to God. They are marked as his special people. In ancient times, a seal commonly indicated possession, much in the way a rancher's brand identifies which cattle belong to him. In the Christian teachings, those who seek that purification of the heart of God's divine care can be certain of it, for the Lord knows those who are his. The saints are sealed by the Holy Spirit for the day of redemption, Ephesians 4. Ownership includes protection from condemnation, and the seal of God protects God's people. Those who lack this seal face the judgment of God. The plagues fall upon, quote, those people who did not have the seal of God on their foreheads. Revelation's use of numbers also suggests that the 144,000 are not meant as a literal count. Since Israel is a symbol for the church, we should not take the 144,000 as a literal number either. Revelation is a book of cosmic symbols, and as we've seen, it uses numbers such as 7 and 12 in symbolic ways. 12 is used as a foundational number, such as in the 12 apostles, 12 tribes of Israel. The number 144,000 is 12 times 12 times 1,000, which then tells us the church is a complete nation of large size. And then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. Revelations 21 compared to 2 Peter 3, but in accordance with his promise, we wait for new heavens and a new earth where righteousness is at home. The new heaven and the new earth represent a new mind and a new heart. Throughout the Old Testament, we've noticed that the Lord makes occasional references to giving us new hearts or circumcising our hearts. The new heaven and new earth John sees is humanity's perfected state of consciousness and regenerated body. The human mind at this point is now one with the divine in the perfection of control and free from outside limitations. Revelations 3, if you conquer, I will make you a pillar in the temple of my God. You will never go out of it. I will write on you the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem that comes down from my God out of heaven in my own new name. The number value for New Jerusalem is 1,224, which is also the numerical value of the Greek word for fish. The same number includes God's creation, paradise, I am the way. The word Jerusalem means sacred peace. So the New Jerusalem is the evolved soul in oneness with divinity. When humanity recognizes the divinity within each one as the controlling force in this world, and turns away from our own selfish pattern of living for self alone, then the old pattern disappears and the Christ pattern emerges. The revelation of St. John is by far the most complex, but also the most complete document in the Bible, describing the nature of human beings and the process by which we can enter into this state of consciousness, of spiritual development. It is presented as a drama wherein the reader is on occasion a dispassionate observer, while in other scenes drawn into full participation as our own higher self unfolds the mysteries of that potential locked deep in the unconscious of our minds. This constantly shifting point of view adds to the complexity of the drama as the mystery unfolds of the gradual metamorphosis of our lower nature, the beast within us, into a divine being. Here now a few more explorations of those words. And I saw when the Lamb, that is the Christ consciousness or higher self, opened one of the seals, that which guards access to the unconscious. And I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder. One of the four beasts, that is our negative nature, saying, come and see. And I saw, and behold, a white horse, our spiritual nature, And he, conscious awareness that sat on him, had a bow, effectiveness, and a crown, princely control, was given unto him. And he went forth conquering and to conquer. And when he opened the second seal, I heard the second beast say, "Come and see." I found it a profoundly traumatic experience when my higher self brought out the first of the mysteries hidden deep in my unconscious. And then, still from the point of view of my lower nature, I felt compelled to witness the vision before me. This is the translation of what we have just heard. And I beheld the spiritual attributes of my human nature, and I realized that he who holds reins over this aspect of his being has the power to vanquish all false images and to conquer all limitations. Another verse. And white robes, that is spiritual protection, were given unto every one of them, they that are redeemed, and it was said unto them that they should rest yet for a little season until their fellow servants and their brethren that should be killed, that is conquered or overcome, should be fulfilled. And I beheld when he, the Lamb, had opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake. And the sun, that is the conscious mind, became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon, the subconscious, became as blood. And the stars of heaven, that is to say the acquired knowledge, the guiding lights, fell unto the earth, our physical awareness, even as a fig tree casteth her untimely figs when she is shaken by a mighty wind. To apply this statement that is so full of esoteric mystery, understand this. And the redeemed qualities that were now part of my spiritual nature, and it became apparent that the redeemed attributes are now indestructible, and as time in the spiritual realm is of no consequence, eventually all negative aspects of my lower nature shall be overcome, even as I have vanquished some of my limitations already. And when my higher self revealed to me the sixth mystery, I became greatly troubled. And my awareness has deserted me completely, even as my subconscious was flooded with the divine presence. And what knowledge I have gathered now tumbled into oblivion, even as that which is incomplete tumbles when faced with the might of spirit. What I've given you here is complex, perhaps completely confusing, but it should at least give you a taste, a sense that in these first century words, in these ancient symbols, are powerful revelations of truth that have to do with us as we are now here in this 21st century. And that when we take them literally, as we have for so many centuries down through the ages, we completely miss the mystery of the spiritual vision that John had for all of us. So because it's about all of us, I want to stop here and let you respond from your encounter with this new angle and see if we can together grasp something of what this extraordinary and mysterious book really means for each of us. So I invite you to ask questions, to make comments, to dialogue about this slice of revelation that we've seen in a whole new way. I leave it to you.
It is.
I will repeat. Thank you. Yes, the question is the image that we get of Jesus in Revelation different than the one we get in the four Gospels? And the reason I say yes is because the four Gospels, although full of deep wisdom, are blended with that historical relationship of the disciples and Christ, of the encounters in historical time, and revelation is a mighty vision of a transcended mind that experienced the cosmic Christ, the post-resurrection Christ, which we just get a taste of in the Gospels. The Christ who says, "Before Abraham was, I am." There's a taste of what we discover in Revelation. The Alpha and the Omega, that eternal dimension incarnated in the flesh, that is ultimately what is revealed in the Gospel and just exploded into symbols in Revelation. That's right. He went off into a new dimension. Absolutely. Well, let me say first of all that you might be surprised to find out that this book of Revelation almost did not make it into the New Testament. We take it for granted. It sounds like a good ending piece, so we assume it's always been there. But there were councils that voted against it. There was another book that almost made it in instead of the book of Revelation. And that's another apocalyptic book called the Gentle Apocalypse, named The Shepherd of Hermas, which is a poetic, beautiful spiritual vision, entirely different from Revelation. So many teachers, many of the leading people of the 300, 400 era were very concerned about the book of Revelation ending up in our hands in the 21st century, because it is so different, it is so bizarre. And their qualification had to do with how much a book not only represented the fundamental sense of what the Revelation means, that is what Christ's presence in the world means, but also how much it was beloved and used by the churches. You all know by now that there were many other Gospels circulating. You've seen the Da Vinci Code, probably. Gospel of Philip, Gospel of Judas, all of that. Greatly loved by different communities. And so it was almost impossible to centralize all this into one accepted piece without upsetting somebody. And it was done, of course, with great prayer and a sense of spirit involved. But nevertheless, it is through these men, these bishops, that we end up with the canon that gives us Revelation. And I wouldn't be terribly surprised that a few of them thought, listen, this is a great ending after Genesis, the beginning and the end. One might argue perhaps it was a mistake, or one might say, well, it was meant to be, so be it. But let's be sure that it has created tremendous, painful controversy. Just like misunderstanding the gospel in other ways has created horrific times in human history, the Spanish Inquisition, the burning of heretics, these insane misrepresentations of Jesus' teachings. You've heard me mention how John Calvin, a leading reformer Protestant, had Michel Servetus burned in Geneva, another brilliant philosopher who had a different take on things. And my question is to you, do you think Jesus would have done that? Of course not. So the craziness of our lower nature is constantly struggling with living rightly our faith. And I want to make this other point. One of the reasons Revelation has been such a bizarre presence in our modern world is because of this whole rapture thing that is so central to the left behind fantasies. And I want you to know that one guy in the late 1800s named Schofield was a disciple of a 12-year-old visionary in Scotland, long forgotten. But Schofield, like so many others, came to, guess where? America, and brought with him his take, his idea of religion based on this strange little sect out of Scotland. And he wrote the Schofield Study Bible that has become a main foundational book down through the generations. And in that book is his version of theology that includes the rapture. The rapture is mentioned in half a verse from Paul. That's it. And think how it has become so central. And if you see the movie of Left Behind, you will see in that scene on the plane, when magically all the good people are raptured, leaving their clothes behind, the extras in that scene who are just sitting around about to be raptured, you will recognize them to be all the evangelical preachers on television who are playing the part. Because the producers assumed, of course, it would be them. And friends, that is the best way to destroy a religion. To make it so absurd that anybody with half a brain can only walk away. The other night I watched the great movie Inherit the Wind. You all remember that, with about the Scopes trial that had such an impact. Imagine if somebody had stood up in the middle of that when it was so polarized, science or religion, and said, what about the symbolism of the 7 days? And in one fell swoop, it would all have been over with. It was never an argument from the Bible to say that God did it in 6,000 years and 7 days. Forget quantum physics. Forget archaeology. That which has separated us and made this schizophrenic situation in the modern world. If the religious people had understood what they were reading, had recognized the mystery and context out of which it came, the ancient Jewish mysticism, the schools of rabbis, the school of John and his gospel, then that simplistic notion would never have become taken for granted. And unfortunately, our scientists, our intellectuals, look at Christianity through the lens of those who don't understand it. Did you catch that? Mark Twain, who rejected Christianity, only saw the fundamentalist, frontier level version of it without any reflection, any integrity about what the deeper meaning might be, what the great teachers had taught down through the centuries. And so obviously you look at that version, you look at what's generally seen on television, and you say, well, forget that. That doesn't compute with anything. So, if nothing else, if all of this is a mishmash that didn't make any sense to you, at least walk away from here with the realization that there's a whole lot more to this than the surface. That we cannot take it in a one-dimensional way, or we immediately destroy its meaning. To some people, that's blasphemy because they've grown up with that version of it. But I suggest to you that if we truly value the Word of God, then we realize that it comes to us not in black and white on a piece of paper, but through the depth of wisdom and traditions of the ancient people from whom it came, with their understanding, their way of speaking, that we then have to translate into our understanding. That word consciousness is of great importance to me. In fact, next week's sermon is about that consciousness. But that word consciousness did not exist in the first century. So you hear Paul mention the third heaven, and we have to mention our way of understanding it. Yes. And Joseph Campbell has helped us in that. I hope some of you in the 80s saw that glorious six-part series with Campbell and Bill Moyers, which revealed that all the myths of humanity in their imagery were expressing some deep intuitive awareness. Perhaps you know that when all is said and done, Joseph Campbell said that the meaning of all those myths ultimately is follow your bliss. If you take that outside of self-gratification and place it at the heart of spiritual awakening, then you can see the connections. Now, in my book there, the Red Book on Tribulation, you'll see the Hopi Indians and others who bring to the table that imagery type expression, communication that we Westerners and rationalists have lost in many ways. Carlos Castaneda in the 70s,
I bet not too many people have read him, right? We got a few. He was studying with a Mexican native Indian and was led out into the intuitive side of the mind, which is imagery, as opposed to the engineer's logic, and exposed to all of these kinds of things, so those four beasts and such. So my bottom line suggestion to all of you is, number one, just don't go home and try to read it and figure it all out right away. You're much better off reading other parts of the New Testament. But know that you can receive understanding if you really prayerfully approach it and let Spirit inspire your experience of it and speak to you through these words, so that it becomes very personal. And then you will have your own unique gift of what these special words mean for you. That has always been a teaching down through the centuries, that Lectio Divina. So that rather than an objective study, you become subjective to what this is, and it has its own revelation for you personally. It's always good to have a compass. It's always good to have a guide. It's always good to check back with the master teachers. But ultimately, it's the inner teacher within you that recognizes something there. And if you don't recognize anything, just go on to something else that feeds you. But the danger that revelation has in this world today, when it is interpreted completely outside of its context, of this spiritual vision, is world war. In the Northwest, I discovered extreme fundamentalists that I'd never met before, who were completely pro-Israel because they wanted Israel to exist, because they firmly believed, according to Revelation, that all the Jews had to be killed in Jerusalem before the rapture or whatever nonsense they'd come up with. And that is so, you know, shocking and disappointing of humanity to have those kinds of misinterpretations. So if you at least consider the possibility that Brother John was, though first century, a human being like us, and had this overwhelming transcendent vision, you know that it ties into your own dreams, to your own longings, and to your own inspiration. And then Revelation isn't such an impossible book, so disconnected from your own life. Any other questions? It's okay to have no questions. It's okay to be silent. I'm going to give you, for better or for worse, a little tiny encore. Y'all know what an encore is, right? Bring him back on stage type thing. Okay, we got one like that. Before we leave here, before we go have a cookie and forget about all this, get some relief, I want to give you just one more taste of how these sacred scriptures can be reinterpreted in our own psychological language of today. So see if you can follow for yourself. And there went out another horse that was red. Red horse is our emotional nature. And power was given to him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth. Earth as our physical awareness. And they, rider and horse, should kill one another. And there was given unto him a great sword, meaning effectiveness. Now, here the reinterpretation, the decoding of what you just heard in the King James Version. I saw the essence of my emotional body, and I sensed that he who allows his emotions to rule his awareness shall surely destroy the serenity of his being. And I saw that the conscious control and uncontrolled emotions cancel each other out with deadly efficiency. And one last one, And I looked, and behold, a pale horse, physical consciousness. And his name, that is his nature or character that sat on him, was Death. Death understood as illusion. And Hell, understood as loss of awareness of the presence of God, followed with him. And power was given unto them over the fourth part of the earth, human consciousness, to kill with sword and with hunger and with death and with the beasts, the negative aspects of the earth, the produce of human nature. And here the decoding of it. And there I beheld the quintessence of my carnal awareness, and I saw that this part of me subsides in a world of utter illusion, in total denial of the higher self within me. Yet this carnal awareness holds sway over one quarter of my human consciousness. It has power to destroy higher impulses by starving my soul of the influx of spirit. It has no notion of the divine presence within me, and it submits to the negative aspects of my lowest instincts. And just to end on a positive note, I want to say that when we understand all of these teachings as universal truth, timeless, outside the box of the images in which we found them, outside of the associations we have with them from childhood, when we rediscover them for what they really are, life-transforming teachings that have profoundly affected brothers and sisters down through the ages, caused people to give their lives for it, then we begin, truly begin, the journey. Until then, we've been hanging around the outside. So I invite you to jump in, make it real for you, make it something that is part of the part and parcel, the fabric of your life, so that it can seed you with that divine wisdom that brings transformation. Thank you for being part of this lecture, for giving of your time this evening.